So I want to begin my talk today with a quote from Jarvis Masters, who's an American Buddhist writer. He's written a couple of wonderful books. He's also a prisoner in California, has been imprisoned for 30 years and on death row for a crime he did not commit. And he's quite an amazing yogi, quite an amazing practitioner. So he says this: "I don't like it when chaplains and other helpers, Buddhist or not, come to the prison with big smiles on their faces and preach about virtue and ethics and always looking at the bright side. I start to feel, am I the only one having a bad thought here?" This may be you too, I don't know. Sayadaw spoke yesterday about seeing the good side. And we can be sitting here going, "Oh, that's not me, I can't do that," or "that's not realistic," or, there's some reaction to that. So Jarvis Masters may be in an actual prison. But all of us, until we are completely enlightened, are in an inner prison of some sort or another, held captive by habits, reactions, tendencies, ghosts of past conditioning. So if you're thinking you're the only person here who is having un-Buddhist thoughts, I have a reality check for you, because it's guaranteed you're not the only person in this room. If I asked for a show of hands, who in the last 24 hours has had an un-Buddhist thought? Yeah, everybody. None of us as human beings is perfect. We wouldn't be in this human realm if we were. So relax. You're not fatally flawed. You're not doing something wrong. It's not because the practice is bad for you, or your personality isn't ideal, whatever you might be thinking along those lines. When you hear "always see the bright side" and you think, "oh, I can't do that." We start where we are. And putting the teachings of the Buddha into practice offers a gradual development to that place of being able to do that, and a gradual maturing, in the same way that we mature as human beings from when we're little kids. Because as any of you who've had kids or been around kids know, little kids are incredibly selfish, or can be. They can be incredibly unskillful. But if our normal psychological development isn't in some way blocked, we mature and along the way slowly learn how to share, how to get out of our little bubble, this place of adulthood where we can see through a lens that isn't just about me. Gradually, sequentially, year by year. So in the practice, it's the same process. Gradually, sequentially, we take on various ways of growing out of self-centeredness to that big-hearted place where everyone is precious and where we can see the good side of even bad people. We can radiate metta even to the monsters of the world, and there are monsters out there. But the free heart can radiate metta and compassion for these people. To get there along the way, we need a framework, a support. A little like, you know, a climbing rose needs a trellis. Otherwise it falls to the ground. So that as we begin to grow, we keep growing in an onward leading direction. So today I want to talk about one such framework. In the teachings, there are a number of articulations of different frameworks, and I want to talk about one today in the context of the metta practice. And that's the framework of the threefold training, also called the three kinds of merit. Yesterday, Sayadaw spoke briefly, day before yesterday. At the end of his talk about dana, he spoke briefly about this, mentioning all three of them, putting them into context, about the various ways we accumulate merit. So the threefold training, just to put it out there at the very beginning, is dana, generosity, that Saito spoke of the other day, sila, ethical conduct, and bhavana, mental development. These are all explicitly and implicitly metta practices. And these ways that we accumulate merit, the three kinds of meritorious action. And merit, punya in Pali, it's the means and the vehicle by which we slowly and gradually go from that prison of me and my reactions and the suffering that comes from that, to the freedom of enlightenment. Meritorious meaning wholesome, good. And that distinction between wholesome and unwholesome, in Pali, kusala, akusala, is a central part of the Buddha's teachings. It's really a core thing that's necessary to understand. Because through the teachings, through these vehicles of dana, sila, and bhavana, we cultivate what is meritorious, what is wholesome, what is useful, what is skillful. And we refrain from cultivating what is unwholesome, useless, unskillful. And as I mentioned in a talk in the first half, wholesome, unwholesome, knowing what is wholesome and knowing what is unwholesome, and feeding the wholesome, cultivating the wholesome, and refraining from the unwholesome is an essential, and I mean this in the sense of the most pithy expression of right effort as a limb of the Noble Eightfold Path. And Ariya briefly mentioned the Eightfold Path in one of her, in her last talk, I think. So when we can make this distinction between wholesome, kusala, unwholesome, akusala, this means we know the difference between the two, and we can directly then feed the wholesome as a training, as a practice. And these three trainings of dana, sila, bhavana give us the support we need and a means to do that, a means to cultivate the wholesome, to disconnect from old unwholesome habits, and to firmly put our feet on the path of awakening. Saito Upandita, who was my preceptor, used to call these three trainings, or these three fields of merit, he called them acts that purify our existence. And they're co-equal parts of the path, each being important. The Buddha offered the first of these, dana, as a training for those who might not, for some reason or another, be ready for the other two. It's the first part. And Saito spoke of it in depth the other day as a form of metta. So I won't say much about it today, except to say that it's the foundation for the rest. Really, it gives us the first glimpse of what it is to have a bigger view, a bigger lens to look through than that small place of me, 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 me. And what can I have? What can I get? Whatever, you know, aspect of that lens we happen to be seeing through. As a practice, dana allows us to learn that offering and making many people happy creates a lot more joy than just making me happy. Ariya mentioned this the other day in a quote, I think, by the Dalai Lama. It's like the world is so much bigger when we care about making other people happy more than we care about making ourselves happy in a small way. And generosity can be taught at a very young age. And this is one incredibly touching thing about being here in Burma. Because often, it's different on this retreat because those of us who've come from far away are making the meal offerings mostly. But when you're at the monastery for a longer time, and you know, many Burmese people come to do the meal offerings, often people offer as a way of celebrating somebody's birthday and a way of celebrating a child's birthday. And these are the most touching dana offerings. A very young child will be brought to the monastery at 5:30 in the morning to offer breakfast. And maybe she's, you know, barely able to walk, but she's got a beautiful dress on, a little crown on her head. She's the princess for the day. It's so touching. And then, just as those of you who've done meal offerings do, they take her and the whole family goes up to the head table and offers the table for the monks. And the little kid, of course, being a little kid, sees all the goodies on the table. And you can imagine what the response is. It's like, ooh. And there's this gentle reinclination. It's like, no, 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 this is for Sayadaw. Look, you get to offer. And they make such a big deal out of what this kid is being able to do. Oh, how wonderful you get to offer to Sayadaw. And look at the beautiful food you're getting, giving him. That's what toddlers learn here. And I remember one time at the monastery, the main center in Yangon, I had an excess of robes. I had been given a lot over, accrued many sets of robes over a period of time. And so I decided, well, I'd make a lucky draw for the nuns. So I had 9 piles of things, some robes, some not, and 9 numbers, and everybody got something, and it was celebratory, it was happy. And before we started, one of the nuns said, oh, is it your birthday? You know, in other words, you know, you're giving all this stuff away, it must be your birthday. And I was so touched by that, because I remembered when she said that, what it was like for me when I was, you know, 7 or 8, and thinking about, what was I going to get for my birthday? Rather than what could I give for my birthday. So the relinquishment, the happy relinquishment of dana, We give something away, materially or monetarily. Can be taught to anybody, even a toddler. And one thing to add about Dana is that although we usually speak about it, and Sayadaw was speaking about it, in terms of generosity, material generosity, generosity in terms of money or things, on retreat, we can also hold it in terms of generosity of spirit, generosity of attitude. We give each other many things here on retreat, and it's really beautiful. And this kind of generosity as a gesture of kindness is so precious. We offer each other silence, verbal silence, nonverbal silence, energetic silence, so that, for example, the people we sit with at the meal table aren't disturbed if we are disturbed. This takes a little, this doesn't just happen, it's a practice to keep our energy in, to keep our eyes from contacting each other. We give each other solitude, space just to be without interruption, space to go through our process without anybody coming up and trying to comfort us, for example. And the most precious thing we can give each other is a sense of safety around each other. All of these are important aspects of the container of the retreat that we were talking about on the first night. They're necessary for deepening the practice. And the silence and the solitude particularly can be challenging for some people. Not for everybody, but for some people. We, as human beings, are social animals. We're not, you know, snow leopards or something, happy to be on our own all the time. So it can be really difficult to unplug from our usual social ways. It can feel very strange when we pass somebody, when, you know, two people are approaching each other and pass, not to smile, not to even look at each other. It can feel kind of weird. It can feel rude. It's not. In this context, it's totally fine. And again, it's not rude to offer somebody solitude. And this can be a particular challenge when you've come with friends or family members, because you're used to connecting. So it's even more challenging for those of you who've come with dear friends. But it's also a gift. And in some cases, there are exceptions to this. You know, and people sometimes say, well, we need to connect for such and such a reason. And actually, usually, we say, oh yeah, no, that makes sense. But please do so discreetly. So there may be special circumstances if you see two people walking together. But please don't take that as blanket permission for everybody to do that. Because the gift of silence and the gift of solitude that we give each other here is actually a source of inner strength. Because when we don't lean on each other as we are used to doing, is how we learn our own strength, our own inner capacity. So even if you want connection, and we all, you know, we all do at some point, to transcend that, to offer yourself and others that gift of deepening. So dana, both material and energetic, this is that first step away from that clenched fist of me. But of course, dana doesn't free the heart completely. More is needed. So that next training, that next field of meritorious action, is ethical conduct, sila. And unlike dana, sila offers us a more systematic training. And it's a training that's really wide-ranging in that it applies to the entirety of our life, all of our speech, all of our action, or I should say the entirety of our outer life. We take the precepts every day for a reason, not just because of empty words. Saido Upandita used to call, speak of sila. After he gave the precepts, he'd say, now you are adorned with the garland of sila. This is the adornment of the heart. And it's hard for me to hear that or even to say those words without getting just a little choked up. Not just because it's beautiful, but because I was born and raised and lived most of my life in Hawaii, a place where we offer and wear garlands. And as a nun, I can't do that. But it's a precious part of the culture. So to know that I can wear a garland, you can't see it. Well, you see the clothes, but this is beautiful. This is precious. And it's a garland that we wear all the days of our lives. Here, at home, no matter where we go, or we can if we want. There's a Hawaiian expression, and you've learned a little Burmese, a little Swiss German, Pali. I'll throw some Hawaiian into the mix. Ele kau, ele ho'oilo ika aloha, which means aloha, love, metta, is worn like a garland through the summers and the winters. Ele kau, ele ho'oilo ike aloha. This so beautifully expresses the continuity of metta when it's expressed through a devoted practice of sila. Taking up this training in ethical conduct all the time, everywhere. And like dana, sila is a practice. Rather than rules to rebel against. And we can take the precepts and go, oh, rules, and, you know, get kind of bloody-minded about it. I don't like rules. I'm not going to follow them. You know, some of us have that conditioning. But if you look at the way they're expressed, each, except for the very last one about metta, each of these precepts is, I undertake the training. Not, I will not do. No, I undertake the training to refrain from. And what that so beautifully implies is we're human beings, sometimes we're going to make mistakes. So if you habitually, for some reason or another, find that you've just broken a precept, just like the meditation practice, you can go, oh, I just lost my mindfulness. I just broke that precept, and you can begin again. You don't get any demerit points for being a bad yogi. In fact, that's good. That's, oh, you're back on track. So it's a practice. And the importance of this practice as the basis for our formal meditation practice, whether it's metta bhavana or vipassana bhavana, really cannot be overemphasized. Because when we truly undertake this training, when we pay attention through the days of our lives, not just here, but outside, to these precepts, these beautiful adornments of the heart, and we do our best to undertake that training, it's a practice that carries us through the day with mindfulness, with metta. So I'm not going to go through each of the precepts. You have the sheet to look at. The overt, obvious way to hold the precept is obvious. You know, not killing, not stealing, not lying, not engaging in this context of retreat anyway, not engaging in sexual contact, and so on. But to deeply undertake this training uses each of the small moments of life as a practice. And each precept can be held in a very refined way, as well as this general, obvious way. So, for example, not taking what isn't given. You know, so we obviously don't steal somebody's shoes that we might see and go, oh, I've always wanted to have those shoes. You know, it's something we've liked and there they are. Well, that's, you know, that's pretty obvious that we don't do that. But in the context, and you don't have to deal with that here so much, but in the context, for example, of a retreat center where you have a shared bathroom, and you go into a shower stall and somebody's left that shampoo you've always wanted to try behind, and you think, oh, they won't notice a little dab gone. That's taking what isn't given. Nobody offered you that. Or even more refined, it's, this is why I mentioned earlier, silence, solitude. So walking up to somebody and engaging them in conversation in the context of the retreat, that's also taking what isn't given. And it might be, you might not mean anything wrong by it, but you're taking their silence. Or, I hope not, but maybe you decide you want to have a phone conversation in your room. And there's somebody else next door trying to practice. That's taking their silence. Or for example, the last precept before the metta precept is one we tend to think, oh yeah, here on retreat in the monastery, I can't break that one. Sitting in a high or luxurious chair or sleeping in a high or luxurious bed. And it's true, you can't explicitly break that precept here. It's impossible, there aren't any. Yeah, none of these chairs are particularly comfortable and our beds aren't either. But what happens when your alarm rings in the morning? Or maybe you hear the bell. I don't hear it because I'm down there, but maybe you hear the bell and you go, oh, it's too early. Sleeping in a high or luxurious bed can also mean, in a more refined way of holding this precept, of luxuriating. You're awake, it's morning, your alarm went off. You actually have the energy, but you just don't want to get out of bed. We've all done this. It's like, oh, never mind. That's a very refined way of breaking that precept. So look in your own practice and see places where you might be able to polish your sila in a refined way. You're all holding the precepts pretty much as human beings can. All of us are doing that. But each of us in our own way can polish the sila. And doing that offers a really profound kind of continuity. Because by polishing the sila in a refined way, we need presence of mind. We need not forgetting. We can't just go on autopilot. It says in the Metta Sutta, one should sustain this recollection. That's what it means. Be mindful. In the original Pali, the word is actually mindfulness. One should resolve upon this mindfulness of metta. That's what gives us continuity through our day. And to hold the precepts in this way is a profound gesture of kindness. It's really so beautiful because you're offering safety to yourself and safety to everybody around you. And the word we use is continuity, but you can also use the word constancy, and I love that word in English because it implies a commitment to being loyal to yourself and to each other and to the practice. And even if you, because of habit, make a mistake, or maybe even because you're feeling rebellious and you make a mistake, you know, that happens too. The practice of sila continues. You just start again. Again and again and again, just like the sitting practice. So one aspect of sila is both the refined and the explicit holding of the precepts. And there's also a closely related aspect of this practice of ethical conduct that's referred to in the very beginning of the Metta Sutta. And that's the practice of just being careful about our attitude towards ourselves and towards each other. And this is definitely a maturing process. I mean, of course, in daily life, anybody who's, well, all of us have been teenagers, and anybody who has been the parent of a teenager, undoubtedly at least once, it's come out of your mouth, "I don't like your attitude." Yeah, our attitude has to mature as human beings. And as yogis. So this particular aspect of maturing as a yogi, as a meditator, requires a deeper degree of unhooking from self-centeredness. So instead of complaining about others and what they're doing, the attitude, taking on attitude as sila, asks that we first take care of our own reactivity, how we are in the world. Because, as I said already, we all make mistakes. And we tend to look outward and complain about that when we see it in other people. It's much easier than dealing with it internally. So when somebody does something unconscious, you know, we get angry and think what a bad person they are and how, you know, self-centered or yada, 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 whatever judgment we might have about that. Without looking internally, just to notice the reaction, taking that reaction on as our metta practice. And here on retreat, it can be any number of things. Both metta retreats and vipassana retreats can be the venues for quiet vendettas, silent vendettas across the dining room table, because I don't know what, you know, I've done this myself too. Or maybe it's about the windows or the lights or the way somebody walks or doesn't walk or the fact that they're talking or they're not talking, or the storylines are endless. And when we're faced with all of this internally, the attitude of kindness and humility requires remembering that we all slip up. And this is an act of generosity towards another person and an act of sila also, you know, not acting from that place of annoyance and maybe disturbing the other person and giving them the space just to be who they are. This is an act of dana and sila in their very refined modes, taking others as they are, taking ourselves as we are, holding everybody in this field of kindness. And to do this, we have to have an attitude really towards ourselves and others that's open, honest, and humble. That humility is really an important aspect of this. And as I said, in the beginning of the Metta Sutta, the Buddha explicitly talks about all of this. Because when you think of it, you know, he was living amongst a community of monks. He knew undoubtedly from painful experience the way people can interact in unskillful ways. So he begins the Metta Sutta by saying, as you know, this is what should be done by one who's skilled in goodness. And that word skill is really important because it implies that it can be developed. And then he says, one of the lines I love the most in this whole sutta, in Pali, it's ujucha, sujucha. They should be straight, very straight. And in Pali, the meaning is the same as in English. Straightness meaning honesty. They should be honest, very honest. And Buddhas don't speak like the rest of us. They don't just go blah, 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 blah. This isn't just a nice little introduction to the rest of the sutta. Every word means something. And the fact that the Buddha doubles down on this and says, honest, very honest, means look at yourself, honestly, and then take another look. This is very challenging. It's very confronting. Because before complaining about somebody else, look at yourself. So after you're honest, the Buddha says, straightforward, gentle in speech. Well-spoken, another translation. Gentle, without too much pride. Ah, here comes the humility part. You know how it is when you think you're right and you see somebody doing something that you think is wrong? How proud you can get. It's like they're just the worst yogis on the planet. And how, why the teachers aren't, you know, you can get, I don't know, I speak for myself. One can get into this little vortex of judgment and superiority. Or maybe you're doing this to yourself internally. It's like, oh, I'm so bad, I'll just never get this. That's not honest either, nor is it gentle. So the humility that can step back, look at yourself honestly, take in those aspects that are not ideal, and hold them with metta, not feed them, but just go, oh, yeah, me too. So the main aspect of this prefers these first couple of lines in the sutta is to emphasize an attitude of gentle but tenacious honesty that's content with both inner and outer conditions. Because the next lines are about contentment. So honesty, humility, contentment. This is profound protection. In the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha says, protecting oneself, one protects others. Protecting others, one protects oneself. And how is it, monks, that by protecting others, one protects oneself? By patience, harmlessness, loving kindness, and sympathy. It is in such a way that by protecting others, one protects oneself. I love this because it's such a beautiful articulation of by protecting others, by giving others that space to be themselves, through harmlessness, loving kindness, sympathy, we protect our own practice. It's a feedback loop, one of many in the Dhamma. So it can help to reflect if you're caught in some reaction towards yourself or towards somebody else. What are you demanding of yourself or of them? Because we've all come here to develop metta, not to be perfect at the outset. You wouldn't need to be here if you were perfect. You know, you wouldn't need to practice. We didn't come here to be ideal manifestations of Dhamma. None of us are, until we're enlightened completely. So judging yourself or judging other people for not living up to that ideal of perfection isn't metta, but it's actually a subtle form of aggression. And we protect ourselves with harmlessness, sympathy, loving kindness. So if that happens, don't beat yourself up for beating yourself up, for please. You know, just take that as a little mindfulness bell. It's like, oh, metta. Oh yeah, may I be at ease anyway. May they be at ease anyway. Let that inform you that you slipped off track and have to start again, that's all. It's not that big a deal. And in the last line of this opening section of the Metta Sutta, it says, the Buddha says, let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. In other words, take care of your sila. Be careful. Padmasambhava, who was a Tibetan adept, said, though my view is as vast as the sky, my attention to the laws of cause and effect of actions is as fine as the grains of barley flour. And any of you who know Sampa know how fine that is. It's like talc. So we have a vast view, but we pay attention in a very refined way to our actions, because actions have consequences, cause and effect. And that's a really high bar. But again, that's the ideal. That's Padmasambhava. But we point ourselves in this direction inexorably. Each moment we pay attention to our sila. We develop this habit so that it becomes our default setting. And we develop that skill. Which brings me to the third limb of this threefold training, this threefold field of merit, that being bhavana, development. Explicit development of the heart, what we're doing here in the meditation practice. Because we gradually do get that vast view and that skill moment to moment to moment, that fine, skillful attention. But it's a long development, a long journey, and it's full of sidetracks and mistakes. So not to be concerned when your practice goes up and down, or you get caught in a judgment loop, or maybe you actually do or say something that you regret. The bottom line is life in this samsaric realm is what it is. We are what we are in this moment. We can't change the conditioning. That already happened. We can't change that. Those conditions brought us here to this moment, and here we are. Cultivating metta, that cultivation, doesn't mean denying that things happen, or pretending that we're perfect. It's not fake, nor is it about result, because we can't paper over our habits. We can't paper over our conditioning. That's magical thinking. But the metta practice trains us to not get caught there, to respond to unwholesome mind states or difficult experiences with kindness and patience and humility, rather than with aggravation, doubt, disappointment, anger, whatever it is. Our response to the world is what the practice deals with. Outer conditions, other people, can't do anything about that. We cultivate metta here in our own heart. The practice isn't meant to change outer conditions. It can't. But eventually, and many of you are already experiencing this, no matter what's happening, there's this balance of kindness. So no matter what happens, no matter what people do or say to us, we can access that metta. We can connect with the heart that is friendly, full of care, tender kindness, and benevolent. No matter what. That's where the bhavana part goes. And that's what we speak about most up here when we give talks. So I'm not going to say much more except to offer, and I'm sure many of you have already seen this and had this reflection, to offer a metaphor. You know, the field next door, especially those of you who have been here for the last 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks. The farmer prepared the soil. He put the seeds in the soil, and they're all coming up. Two batches of some kind of vegetable seed. It's some kind of cabbage cauliflower plant of some sort. And they're all just growing. Every day he goes out there, he's watering, he's taking care of them. And they're growing. And this is what bhavana is. Every time we repeat a phrase, every time we incline to the metta, no matter what, we're planting a seed. And the continuity is the water. So as you know, and as you're experiencing by watching what's happening next door, it isn't instant. It's not like you plant the seed and in the next day you have cauliflowers. The cauliflower that he's been harvesting over there, he planted a long time ago. It's the same with the practice. So please be patient with yourselves. This is also metta. And it's also humility. Don't demand instant results, because you're never going to get them with that demand. So just keep going is really the bottom line, the basic instruction. And that creates that habit of inclining to kindness no matter what. That habit of a fiercely loving honesty that can connect and care no matter what. This is also a garland, a lei, that one wears through the summer and the winter. And I love that expression, that Hawaiian expression. ele kau ele ho ilo ike aloha. Because when you make a garland, it takes time, it takes patience. No matter how you do it, there are various ways of making garlands. But no matter how you do it, you need care, you need connection, you need time. And there are many, many ways, infinite number of ways of weaving a garland of flowers. Depending on the flowers you have, what's in bloom, what you like. And each one of them is beautiful and fragrant. So depending on conditions, depending on the infinite numbers of causes and conditions that bring each of us here, we each weave our own lei, and each one is beautiful. And all you have to do is keep weaving, just keep going. And it doesn't matter how long it takes. The end result is what matters. And if you just keep going, that will happen by itself. So these three fields of meritorious action, these three trainings, in completely engaging with each of them, we bring protection to ourselves and protection to the world. So, I offer a really heartfelt wish that this metta garland you are weaving, this garland of dana, sila, bhavana, be an abiding beautification of your heart, and may it be the cause and condition of your complete awakening. Thank you, everybody, for your attention, and thank you for your practice.